So the meditation on Red Yellow Manjushri starts out with refuge in bodhicitta, as do all of our practices. And sometimes people think, well, we do refuge in bodhicitta all the time, so we can skip over this part because we know it already. But actually, I think refuge and bodhicitta are kind of the basic essential thing in the whole path, and that if you look closely, almost everything can be fit into it in one way or another. It's interesting, because refuge teaches us how to be content being within ourselves, and bodhicitta teaches us how to be with others. So it's a very interesting process, because refuge is an internal process of, you know, understanding the three jewels and taking refuge, you know, in the three jewels, both the causal one and the resultant one. And so that's an internal process of gaining that kind of conviction. Bodhicitta is helping us learn how to be together with others and be peaceful in that way. So I think that's quite interesting, yeah? Now, I'll explain refuge in bodhicitta from a Mahayana viewpoint. Just know that within Buddhism there are a variety of interpretations, which I will not go into tonight, but you might be interested in learning those at some time. And instead, I will just talk about how we see it in our tradition. Okay? So, if we start out with the Four Noble Truths, which is the basic format of all of the Buddhist traditions and all the Buddhist teachings, okay? You start out with, we have dukkha, okay? Dissatisfactoriness, suffering, misery, whatever you call it, yeah? So we have this. The second one, there's a cause. Okay, what's the cause from the Buddhist viewpoint? Our own ignorance, anger, and attachment. Yeah. Now, what are ignorance, anger, and attachment? Are they some kind of external thing? No, they're internal. They're consciousnesses. So to understand how ignorance, anger, and attachment function, you have to understand what mind is. Okay? So the definition of mind is clear and knowing. Okay? Clear because two meanings. One, because the mind is formless, and also clear because it's able to reflect objects. And the mind is knowing or aware because it's able to engage with objects. Now, within this category of mind, there's many different kinds of mind. Yeah, mind isn't one solid lump. There's many different kinds of consciousnesses. We have our sense consciousnesses and our mental consciousnesses, and we have, you know, different, we have gross and subtle and extremely subtle levels of mind, and we have mental factors that, you know, do different functions within any conception, and so on and so forth. If you want to study this more in depth, you can study Lohrig, which is called Mind and Awareness. There's a whole set of tapes in the library about it, if you missed those teachings a few years ago. Okay, so the basic nature of mind, you know, again from a Mahayana viewpoint, is that it's something clear and pure. Yeah? Now, within that, you know, some consciousnesses, like ignorance, anger, and attachment, are deluded. They misperceive objects. But the basic foundation, you know, of the mind, the basic nature of the primary minds, you know, the sense consciousnesses and mental consciousness, the basic nature of the clear light mind that goes, you know, this extremely subtle mind that goes from one life to the other, is just that it's pure. In other words, it's not inherently contaminated by anything, and it's not inherently existent either. So for that reason, all the defilements can be removed from the mind. Yeah, because the defilements all rest on this grasping at inherent existence. If the mind's not inherently existent, and if ignorance is not an inherent part of the mind, then ignorance can be removed, and thus, you know, attachment, anger, jealousy, pride, laziness, and the whole rest of the guys can be removed also. Okay, so what we have when we talk about Buddha nature, yeah, is we're talking about this pure nature of the mind, and it can be talked about in two ways. One way is the natural Buddha nature, and this is the emptiness of inherent existence of the mind. Okay? So it's a permanent phenomena. It's the lack of true existence of the mind. Yeah? Then, together with that, you have the evolutionary Buddha nature, which just means the clear and knowing of the regular, conventionally existent mind, what I was just talking about when I mentioned clear and knowing. Okay? So, in Open Heart, Clear Mind, actually, there's a chapter on Buddha nature. You might want to review it. So because we have this Buddha nature, both those kinds of Buddha nature, because we need both of them, yeah, then because the mind on a conventional level is not inherently tainted, on the ultimate level it's not inherently existent, therefore the ignorance, anger, and attachment can be removed, yeah. When you remove them, what you get is the third noble truth, the true cessation, and the path that gets you to that is the fourth noble truth. Okay? Basically, the wisdom realizing emptinesses, all those different kind of consciousnesses that are wisdom consciousnesses that help you remove all the defilements. So that's a rough, you know, view. There's much more to be said. You know, that's very general. But if everybody has Buddha potential, these two kinds of Buddha nature, then it's possible for everybody to become a Buddha. Okay? And there's no big gap, there's no some kind of chasm between sentient beings and Buddhas, because, you know, both of our minds are empty of inherent existence, and both of our minds conventionally are clear and knowing. The thing is that we have the clouds in the sky that are obscuring all of this. Okay, the clouds of ignorance, anger, and attachment. So, everybody has the potential to become a fully enlightened being. Now, this is kind of revolutionary, actually, when you think about it. Yeah, like I said, this is not the tenet that's held in all the different Buddhist systems, and it's certainly not the tenet held in other religions, okay, where there's definitely a gap between sentient beings and, you know, the divine beings, okay? But in Buddhism, it's the gap is only, you know, it's not a rigid gap, it's not a chasm that's insurmountable, it's just a question of whether the defilements have been removed or not, and it's possible to remove those defilements. Now, when you remove the defilements, and everybody has the potential to do this, then what you get is the Buddha. Okay? So, what is the Buddha? Well, we can talk about the Buddha sometimes in terms of two kayas, and you can divide it also into three kayas or four kayas or even five kayas, okay? So, but they all come down to the same thing. It's just different ways of categorizing it. The way, if we start out with two kayas, okay, we start out with the Dharmakaya and the Rupakaya. Dharmakaya means truth body. Rupakaya means form body. When we say body here, it doesn't mean blood and guts body. It means body as in a corpus or in a collection or a group, that kind of body, you know, like a body of people, yeah, or a body of texts. It's not body, you know, like an arm and a leg. Okay, so the Dharmakaya there refers to the aspect of the Buddha's mind, and that's the truth body, and the Rupakaya, the form body, refers to the different manifestations that the Buddha appears in order to communicate with sentient beings. Why does the Buddha appear in different manifestations? Because we're pretty dull, aren't we? And, you know, we can't tune in to the Buddha's omniscient mind. We don't have that frequency within us. Yeah, it's kind of blocked out by too much radio, you know, too much interference from the TV and the VCR. And, you know, we don't have that that frequency. So the Buddha, out of compassion, manifests in different physical forms because we are very physically based people, form-based people. We relate to sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touches and things like that. So the Buddha, out of compassion, appears in these various forms in order to communicate with us. Okay? So if we take the Rupakaya, it can be divided into two types. You have the Sambhogakaya, and you have the Nirmanakaya. Sambhogakaya means enjoyment body, and this is the body of light that the Buddha manifests in a Pure Land to teach the Arya Bodhisattvas. Okay, so those are, you know, for very high level beings who can tune into the, you know, the Buddha appearing in a body of light, teaching Mahayana teachings and subtle Vajrayana teachings, yeah. Then there's the Nirmanakaya, which is the emanation body, and this is a grosser form that the Buddha appears in order to communicate with the rest of us dum-dums, okay? Maybe I should speak for myself, but, you know, in case there's a few more like me. Okay, and so here, you know, the Buddha appears, the Nirmanakaya is, for example, Shakyamuni Buddha, a Buddha who appears on this earth when it's a dark age. In other words, when there's no teaching of the Buddha, there's no talk of the three higher trainings, the Four Noble Truths. You know, there's no path being taught here on earth. So the Nirmanakaya Buddha, one form of Nirmanakaya, appears in order to teach, like Shakyamuni Buddha. There's other kinds of Nirmanakaya Buddhas. You could say, you know, any kind, any emanation on this earth that appears in order to communicate with us could be a Nirmanakaya Buddha. Now, here's where it gets interesting if we want to weave guru yoga into this whole process. And this is a tantric practice, and in tantra, you know, what you're trying to do is to see your tantric master as a Buddha, okay? Now, how can that be possible? Well, because you have these two kinds of form bodies, and one kind is a Nirmanakaya. Okay, and which could be somebody appearing on this earth. So if you start from the viewpoint of the Buddha's omniscient mind, and then you think, you know, that the Buddha can appear as your teacher in order to guide you, I mean, why not? It's completely possible, isn't it? If you think of it, you know, what, the Buddha went to all that hassle to get enlightened, and then afterwards they're just going to say forget it and let somebody who's unenlightened, you know, lead you to enlightenment? You know, I mean, I don't think the Buddha's going to do that. So, you know, when we think like that, then we get some feeling, well, our teachers could be Buddhists. Now, I'm not talking about people like me. I'm talking about people like His Holiness and your tantric masters. Because this view of seeing the guru as the Buddha is not common to all of Buddhism. You know, it's only important in your Vajrayana practice. It's not even in general Mahayana. There, it's just seeing your teacher as an emanation of the Buddha, you know, or in your refuge practice as a representative of the Buddha. Okay? So don't get into some weirded out thing about, oh my Guru is a Buddha, and, you know, I can see them with a body made of light, and everything they do is perfect, and I rally, abracadabra, there's this holy being I'm going to worship. Maybe they'll bonk me on the head and bless me and tie a string around my neck. And, yeah, I mean, don't get weirded out, okay? And I say this for a good reason, because a lot of people do. But, you know, I'm trying to talk, you know, as mature practitioners, you know, if you think of it, yeah, you know, somebody like His Holiness the Dalai Lama could, you know, be a Nirmanakaya Buddha appearing on this earth in order to guide and teach us. Why not? When you look at what he teaches us, how he teaches us, the perfect guidance, you know, if Buddha came here specially, is Buddha going to teach anything else different? Yeah? Okay? And so if we think this way, it helps us take the teaching seriously, and it gives a new kind of dimension to our spiritual practice, and it draws us into something that's a little bit more mystical. Okay? You know, in other words, it's making us begin to see that maybe everything we see with our eyes doesn't exist the way it appears to us. Okay? And this is part of the value of seeing our teacher as a Buddha, is that it makes us begin to doubt our ordinary perception. And when we doubt our ordinary perception, that draws us into thinking about emptiness. Because what is emptiness about? It's about the fact that what our senses tell us, what our senses perceive, is wrong. And even the way we conceptualize things is wrong. In other words, because we're always, in terms of our senses, things that are appearing inherently existent to us. In terms of our conceptual mental consciousness, we are generally grasping those things as inherently existent. Okay? And there you have, you know, the basic, when we talk of the two obscurations, there you have it. Okay? The grasping and inherently existent, which is easier to eliminate, is the deluded obscuration that prevents us from becoming an arhat. The appearance of true existence, even to our senses as well as to our mental consciousness, is the cognitive obscurations that prevent us from becoming a Buddha. Okay, so when we begin to have this kind of doubt, it draws us into thinking about emptiness and what are things empty of. Okay, because emptiness doesn't mean they're non-existent. It means that they're empty of inherent existence. But they are full of dependent arising, because that's how they exist. Okay? So it's an interesting interplay, isn't it? When you start thinking about this and you get into the four kayas, and then you can begin to understand where in Vajrayana this teaching of seeing the guru as the Buddha, how it plays an important part in that practice, and how that draws you into thinking about emptiness, and how Vajrayana is essentially, the whole thing is a meditation on the union of emptiness and dependent arising. Okay? It's very cute. In Singapore, I got this email, and they asked me to give a talk called The Magic of Vajrayana. And I wrote back, and I said, I don't want to talk on that. And they said, well, we printed the posters already. And I said, well, okay, if you printed the posters, you know, you can distribute them. But please be aware that, you know, I agree with you that it's nice to have catchy titles, but the catchy titles should reflect reality, and Vajrayana is not magic. And if people come expecting magic, they're going to be very disappointed in the talk that I give. And then they're going to be critical because I didn't stick to the topic. So they wrote back and they said, okay, we'll change the title of the talk. you know. But Vajrayana, you see, it's not magic. It's nothing whatsoever to do with magic. Yeah? It's a meditation on the union of the two truths, emptiness and dependent arising. Yeah? Okay, so let's go back to the four Buddha bodies. You know, remember we had Dharmakaya and Rupakaya. Within the Rupakaya, there were the two kinds. And then when we talked about the Nirmanakaya, we can begin to see how our teachers are Nirmanakaya Buddhas appearing in order to benefit us, and how that helps us have more faith and take the teachings more seriously, and how it helps us to begin to look beyond our ordinary appearance and ordinary grasping at it. Now, if you go over to the other side, the Dharmakaya, the truth body, which is the Buddha's mind, that can also be subdivided into two. So there you get the Jhana Dharmakaya, or the wisdom truth body, and you get the Svavavikakaya. Okay, you can look up how to spell it. I use SVA as an abbreviation. And that's called the nature body. Okay, now, what are these two? The wisdom Dharmakaya, the wisdom truth body, Jhana Dharmakaya, is the omniscient mind of a Buddha. Okay, so this is an impermanent phenomena that is eternal. Okay, impermanent simply means it changes moment by moment. Anything that functions changes moment by moment. It doesn't mean that it's contaminated or diluted, you know, because in the case of the Buddha's mind, or even an Arya's mind perceiving emptiness, those are pure minds, okay? But it still changes moment to moment because it's a consciousness, and any consciousness that's perceiving an object, you know, doesn't perceive the same thing one moment to the next, so the mind changes, yeah? But the Buddha's wisdom mind is eternal, because once it has purified all of the obscurations, then there is no cause for the obscurations to come back again. So once a Buddha, always a Buddha. Okay? So that's why it's eternal. And the Buddha's mind doesn't end. Okay? It doesn't matter whether a Buddha is in a physical body on this earth as a Nirmanakaya or, as a Sambhogakaya Buddha in a pure land. The Buddha's mind, consciousness, does not end, because it's just the nature, the basic nature is clear and knowing, and one moment of clear and knowing produces the next moment of clear and knowing, which produces the next moment of clear and knowing, which is the same in our consciousness. One moment of clear and knowing produces the next. And that's also how we can meditate and trace back and get a feeling of how we have beginningless consciousness also, because one moment of consciousness came from the previous moment. Okay? So just in terms of this flow of clear and knowing consciousness, there's no beginning and there's no end. Yeah. There's an end to the samsaric mind. Okay, there's an end to the contaminated mental aggregates. Okay, remember the four mental aggregates of feeling, discrimination, volition, compositional factors, and the primary minds? Okay, there is an end to those contaminated four mental aggregates, as there is an end to our form aggregate, this body dies. But, because there's an extremely subtle mind, that is just the nature of clear and knowing, and that is uncontaminated by its nature. It's not inherently existent, and it's not inherently contaminated. Therefore, one moment of consciousness can produce the next one, and even we become enlightened. Enlightenment has a beginning, but enlightenment doesn't have an end, because one moment of wisdom produces the next moment of wisdom. Okay? So here you have the Buddha's mind, going on throughout, infinite time. So that's the wisdom truth body. Then you have the nature truth body, the Svabhavikakaya. And this is a permanent phenomena. In other words, it's something that's unconditioned. It doesn't change moment by moment. And this, too, can be divided into two kinds. So this is how you're going to get five kayas. So if you divide it into two kinds, the Svavikakaya, one is just the emptiness of inherent existence of the Buddha's mind, and the second is the true cessations of a Buddha's mind. Okay? So the emptiness of inherent existence and the true cessations, meaning the, elimination, the removal, the exhaustion of any defilement in such a way that it's no longer returns. And if you follow certain commentaries and certain Gelupa monasteries, they will tell you that true cessations are also emptinesses. But this is a big topic of debate, okay, which I won't get into at this point. But it's a very interesting topic of debate, and it really draws you into kind of an incredible way of thinking about emptiness that takes your mind completely somewhere else, okay? Now, you might say, all this stuff and all these Buddha bodies and all this Sanskrit, and I can't keep it straight. But it's very interesting if you start to think a little bit about what the Buddha is from this kind of viewpoint. You get this whole incredible, expansive feeling, don't you? It's like there's so all these different beings who have become Buddhas, because everybody has the Buddha nature. So some beings have already become Buddhas already. There's not just Shakyamuni Buddha, there's not just the thousand Buddhas of this fortunate eon. There's all these beings who have become Buddhas even since Shakyamuni lived on this earth, even before Shakyamuni lived on this earth. There's all these Buddhas, they have omniscient mind, they perceive all phenomena all the time without any effort. Okay, it draws you into this feeling of like, wow, being a Buddha is, you can do some pretty wonderful things if you're a Buddha, because if you have that ability to know all phenomena, that means that you know sentient beings' karma. It means you know all the different techniques of all the different paths on how to guide somebody slowly, gradually, according to their interests and disposition at this particular moment. Do you know the way how to guide them, you know, from where they are now to full enlightenment? Even if it takes 50, 100 million eons to do it, you're going to know how to do it. Okay, because you know their nature, their dispositions, you know the teachings they need to hear, you know how to say the right thing at the right time, you know, so that you don't blow it all the time like most of us do. We try and help and instead we create more problems. So Buddha doesn't do that because they have all this kind of, they know everything, yeah? So therefore the Buddha becomes a really reliable guide on the path to enlightenment, which is why we take refuge in the Buddha and we don't take refuge in spirits. Okay? Because spirits aren't enlightened beings. They're sentient beings like us. Okay? But if you think about, you know, the Buddha in terms of the four kayas, it gives you an incredible feeling about what a Buddha can do. And if you think that the whole reason that any person got the four kayas is out of bodhicitta, okay? In other words, bodhicitta is the principal cause for enlightenment. If you don't have the bodhicitta motivation, impossible to be enlightened, with a capital I, impossible. If you leave one sentient being out of your compassion, impossible to get enlightened. Okay, so that also indicates to us how valuable each sentient being is and why we should be kind to them, because our enlightenment depends on them. Okay? So, you see that bodhicitta is the whole impetus to become a Buddha. Yeah, if you don't have bodhicitta, there's no reason to do so many hard practices to try and become a Buddha. Okay? Because the whole purpose of becoming a Buddha is so that you can have the four bodies, so that you know what sentient beings need, and so that from your own side, you have the capacity to manifest that. So a Buddha with the wisdom of truth body knows all these things, and then can manifest different form bodies, either as nirmanakayas, as sambhogakayas, can manifest whatever anybody needs at that particular time. And when a Buddha manifests these different bodies, they do so completely spontaneously, effortlessly. So a Buddha doesn't have to sit there and go, well, Sam's out there in Nigeria today, I wonder what I can do to benefit him, lead him to enlightenment. Shall I do this? Well, I'm not sure. Maybe I should do that. How can I benefit Sam in Nigeria today? Gee, I'm very confused. You know, Buddha, you know. And then as he finally says, well, you know, Sam could really use a doctor to help him get better, and if he got better, he could practice the Dharma, but I'm really too lazy to manifest as a doctor today. You know, it's just too much effort. I want to take out some time and sleep, because I've been working all these eons for sentient beings already, and I just want to sleep today, okay? Buddha doesn't have this problem. Yeah, I mean, Buddha sees Sam in Nigeria and boing, you know, there's an emanation there. If Sam has the karma. Okay, if Sam doesn't have the karma, nothing the Buddha can do. Okay, which is why it's so important for us to create good karma, because if we create good karma, our good karma is like hooks drawing the Buddhas to us. Okay, Buddhas don't have a choice. Yeah. You can say they're out of control. They don't have a choice. Yeah. They don't have a choice because they are totally controlled by compassion. Yeah. So if a sentient being has that karma to be able to be benefited, and that those hooks are coming out of a sentient being's good karma and a sentient being's prayers and a sentient being's aspirations, the Buddha doesn't have a choice. And like that, without thinking, without effort, spontaneously manifest whatever is needed. You know, maybe it's a telephone, maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a teacher, it can be anything. Okay? And the Buddha does it, and he doesn't make this big pronouncement about it. You know, hey guys, I'm manifesting for you. Okay? I mean, they say the Buddha can even manifest as a bridge. And I had a very interesting experience. I've never really told people this. But one time, this was many years ago, at Koh Phan, and it was extremely cold, and I can't remember the situation, but for some reason, what was it? I don't know, but we couldn't get in our rooms to sleep that night, and we had to sleep in the tent, and there were no blankets around, and it was freezing, and we went out and we came back and there were two blankets. And we slept, and in the morning we folded the blankets and they disappeared. I mean, I didn't see them disappear, but I never knew what happened to those blankets. And I always had the thought, maybe I had some good karma. Yeah. And I had another experience when my first exposure to Buddhism, you know, when I came back from my 3-week course, I was all, Pollyanna Bodhisattva, okay? Mickey Mouse Bodhisattva. And I went to the bakery and I was going back into the car. These are the days where I used to drive, okay, before I became a nun. And there was some drunken guy sitting in the alley near where the car was. So, Pollyanna Bodhisattva, pulls out a donut from her donut bag and gives it to this guy. And I put it in his hand, and he goes like this, and he's like totally wiped out, And he just squishes it like this in his hand, and it just crumbles and falls. And that was a very big teaching for me. Yeah? It was a very, very big teaching for me. And I've always had this doubt, I wonder if that was an emanation of the Buddha. Because somehow it was something very important for me. Yeah? So, periodically these kinds of things happen. But, you get the feeling that, being a Buddha, we benefit directly from Buddhas who have the four Buddha bodies, okay? And if we can become a Buddha, imagine how much good we can do, It's not just the good that we can do in this one life with this one body. It's not just, giving people bread or giving people medicine. It's wonderful to do social service and social engagement practices. And the Buddhist community definitely needs to be involved in that. But the real way to help sentient beings is to help them abandon negative actions and practice positive actions and teach them the Dharma so that they can eventually attain liberation and enlightenment. Yeah. Now, if we have, the ability of a fully enlightened Buddha doing all of this, whether helping them in socially engaged Buddhism or helping them in terms of leading them to enlightenment, we just have much more ability to do this. So this is a definite plug for the advantages of attaining enlightenment. Okay? If you don't want to buy this product, you aren't listening properly. Yeah. Forget the laundry soap. You want enlightenment. And you don't want enlightenment for your own benefit, because like I said, you don't need to hassle so much to accumulate so much, merit for three countless great eons if you don't want to benefit sentient beings. Just get yourself out of samsara, be in ahara, and that's good enough. But if you want to benefit sentient beings, then you need some extra inner reserve and you need to do this extra work, okay? So we don't want to become enlightened because, enlightenment is best and I want the best and I want the highest and, I'm going to compete with the Buddha to be as good as the Buddha and, maybe some people will give me some original chocolate chunk cookies. It's just what you need when you're a Buddha, huh? That's not why you want to become a Buddha, okay? You want to become a Buddha because you're 100% committed to helping sentient beings. That's the only reason. Okay, so if you have this view of what Buddhahood is with the four kayas and it lasting ad infinitum, eternally, throughout infinite time, throughout infinite space, okay, then generating bodhicitta makes sense, doesn't it? Okay, if you can attain the four kayas and have that kind of qualification to benefit sentient beings like that, there's a definite purpose for generating bodhicitta. If there's no possibility to attain the four kayas, why generate bodhicitta? You know, if it's just, you know, I'm going to get enlightened and I'll be enlightened this life and I'll do some good things and then I die and that's it. Why hassle? You know, because it's just from now until when you die, and you know, who knows, you might get enlightened and die the next day. Yeah? But if you have the possibility of, you know, throughout infinite time and infinite space, working only for the benefit of sentient beings, then bodhicitta makes a whole lot of sense. Okay? So you see why refuge and bodhicitta come first, and you see why they're related to each other? And you see why having this view of refuge in bodhicitta sets the whole stage for the tantra practice that you're going to do. Yeah? Because when you're meditating on Manjushri, yeah, you're seeing Manjushri as like a Sambhogakaya form. You know, you're trying, when you do the self-generation as Manjushri, you're seeing your body as a Rupakaya, and you're seeing your mind as the Dharmakaya. Yeah, this is what you're trying to create the causes to attain, and the way you create the causes is through this tantric yoga meditation where you dissolve into emptiness and then generate your wisdom mind as, you know, and all your potential as the two Buddha bodies. Okay? So without this view of enlightenment, doing the Manjushri practice, or Vajrasattva, or Chenrezi, or Tara, or any of the daily practice, it doesn't make any sense to do it unless you have this view of the four kayas. I mean, you can still do the practice, and of course it feels very wonderful. You visualize Manjushri and light comes and you gain wisdom, or you visualize, you know, Chenrezi and you emanate light and, you know, your compassion increases. You can still do the practice and it still helps you and it's still beneficial. But do you see that if you have this understanding of the four kayas, your whole understanding of what this practice is about is totally different than if you're just doing the practice because it makes you feel good. Yeah? And, you know, many people come to Buddhism because they want to do something that makes them feel good. And that's great. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah? But if you want to sustain a long-term Dharma practice and you really have high spiritual aspirations, you know, then your motivation has to deepen, and it deepens because you get a different understanding of what your potential is, so you begin to understand Buddha nature, okay? You understand the Four Noble Truths, you understand refuge, okay? And you want to help sentient beings, and so you do this kind of practice because it helps you create the causes for a Buddhist form body and a Buddhist truth body. Yeah, because in this practice you are dissolving into emptiness and you are generating. When you generate yourself as Manjushri, that's the Rupakaya, and you're thinking of your mind as the Dharmakaya. Okay? And the whole idea is then you start thinking of yourself as a Buddha, you develop that self-image, that begins to change the way you relate to yourself and the way you relate to the environment, which changes the way you act, so then it influences the karma you create, the causes you create, you know, whether you're doing the collection of positive potential and the collection of wisdom, or whether you're doing the collection of how to get reborn in the hells without really trying. You know? Okay? So, you know, this is going to be the thing that's going to make the difference in it. Yeah? And what your motivation is, and what your understanding of what the meaning of your life is, and what direction you want to go in. Okay? Because you understand what your potential is, and you understand what a Buddha can do, and you want to do that. Okay? So, when you're taking refuge, okay, the Buddhas, like I just explained, like the four kayas, the Dharma are the true cessations and the true paths, okay? So, the true paths are all those consciousnesses that, you know, enable us to remove the various defilements in such a way so that they never appear. And the true cessations are each cessation of each defilement, you know, which you gain gradually as you progress along the path. You know, there's a gradual process of eliminating different defilements at different levels of the path. When you cease those completely, you get that different true cessation. When you become a Buddha, you have all the true cessations, okay? So it's like you got all your marbles in the bag, Yeah, you got it all. So that's the Dharma refuge, what you're aiming for. The Sangha refuge, yeah, you can see the Sangha, at the Sangha that we're taking refuge in here, are the Aryas, those who have direct realization into emptiness. In other words, their minds are the true paths, you know, not all of their consciousnesses are true paths, but their minds that realize emptiness directly are true paths, and they have some true cessations in their mind streams because they've begun to eliminate different defilements from the root, so they never appear. So they're also very reliable guides. Yeah. So when we think of the three jewels that we take refuge in, this is what we're thinking of. Okay? So to understand the refuge, we have to understand the Four Noble Truths, we have to understand emptiness, we have to, you know, understand Buddha nature. But all these things are really interwoven. Yeah? So don't think that refuge is some kind of beginner baby practice, you know, that you do at the very beginning. Oh, I took refuge, now what can I do that's higher? Actually, refuge is an incredibly, you know, complicated practice, because what we're trying to do is make ourselves into the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, we take refuge in the cause of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, those that already exist external to us. We take refuge in their guidance so that we can become the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha ourselves, so that we can emanate all these bodies throughout infinite space to benefit sentient beings, because our mind is completely liberated from all the defilements. Okay? So refuge is actually quite a profound practice, and, you know, do you see how that idea of the Buddha fits in with the bodhicitta and why bodhicitta is so important? Okay, so bodhicitta is not just love and compassion. Yeah, we often in Dharma circles throw around, somebody's nice to me, oh, they're a bodhisattva. I wish. I wish every time I gave somebody a piece of chocolate I was a bodhisattva, but I'm not, okay? So, you know, bodhicitta is having that aspiration to become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings, and having that continuously in our mind. So we need to cultivate that a lot. That takes a lot of effort, you know. But at a certain point, it too is going to become spontaneous, and then after a while of developing that, it's going to become irreversible, and we're never going to be able to lose it. And that bodhicitta becomes very powerful, because it's just this incredible engine pushing you forward, you know, because you want to attain Buddhahood, because you realize all sentient beings are counting on you to do it. Okay? And sometimes we kind of hang back and we go, well, there's already all these infinite Buddhas, you know, why do I need to become Buddha? There's infinite Buddhas already, you know, they can help the sentient beings, I'll just kind of take my time. Well, that doesn't work either, you know. Why? Because when we're sentient beings, yeah, we have different karmic connections with different sentient beings. I mean, we can see that right now, can't we? I mean, we all have a very close karmic connection. You know, and especially you, some of you have been coming years and years to class, you know, we have close karmic connection. Or other people in your life that you're very close to, you have close karmic connection. Now, when you become a Buddha, you're going to be in, you know, prime time for helping those people that you have close karmic connections with. Yeah, and somebody who's born 5 million universes away who doesn't have that close karmic connection with them is not going to be able to help them in the same way you can. Okay? So that's why each of us individually needs to become a Buddha, because of the particular karmic connections we have with sentient beings that, you know, is going to enable us, you know, to benefit them more. Now, it doesn't enable us to benefit them more from our side. It's because from their side, having that karmic connection, they're going to be more open, more receptive, more, you know, whatever, to receiving the Dharma from us. So we have to do something to help them. Yeah, we can't flake out and say, I'll leave it to the rest of the Buddhas. Okay? So this is a really good thing to think about when, you know, our mind just wants to, you know, throw everything away and say it's too much. You know, think about the people you really love and the people you're really close to, and ask yourself, you know, can I throw them away? You know, and often, you know, that pulls out something quite beautiful in us, because sometimes we're willing to, to be lazy, even though it harms us, but we aren't willing to be lazy when it harms the people we love. Okay? Questions, comments?
I'm trying to quite get the subtle distinction between guru is Buddha and guru is an emanation of Buddha.
His Holiness talks a lot about this, you know, different ways that we see the guru. So I'll just explain the three different ways and how they correspond with the three different levels of practice. In your basic Vinaya practice, okay, you know, refuge in your five lay precepts, there you see your preceptor as a representative of the Buddha. They represent the Buddha in that they have the lineage and they give you the precepts and they give you the refuge and they enable you to connect with this whole lineage of practitioners that's coming from the time of Shakyamuni Buddha down to today. So you see your preceptor as a representative of the Buddha in that way because they are. They're representing the Buddha to you. Okay? Now, in the Mahayana practice, where you're striving to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings, yeah, then you see your guru as an emanation of the Buddha. Okay, that gives this feeling like there's a little bit of space somehow, because our minds still tend to think, well, the Buddha's out there, so, you know, this person isn't the real Buddha, you know, they're just kind of like a light beam coming off of the Buddha, you know, Buddha emanated this guy to teach me, but they, you know, somehow in our mind we respect them more than if we see them as a representative, but still there's some kind of gap between them and the Buddha because they're an emanation of the Buddha. Okay, but still, seeing our teachers in that way is very, very helpful because it helps us take the teachings more seriously, doesn't it? Now, if you're doing the Vajrayana practice, yeah, which is a branch of the Mahayana, then you want to train your mind, especially in highest yoga tantra, to see that your tantric master is a Buddha. Okay, this doesn't mean anybody who has the name teacher is a Buddha. It doesn't mean anybody who is your teacher is a Buddha, because somebody can be your Vinaya teacher or your Mahayana teacher, okay? But it's specifically emphasizing here the people who give you tantric initiations, because when you're doing the initiation, the teacher is visualizing themselves as the deity, you know, and you want to be able to think that you're taking the initiation directly from the actual deity. Okay? And in fact, you know, there's some kind of way in which I think that, you know, the Buddha really comes and is, you know, is there in the form of the deity at that time. You know, our teacher happens to be this conduit. But, you know, it enables us to make that kind of connection. And so if we're trying to train our mind to see our teacher as the actual Buddha. Now, okay, we shouldn't go into, sometimes people do this thing of, oh, my teacher's the Buddha, but everybody else, ugh, all these sentient beings, I want to watch my, I'll wash my teacher's bowl, and I'll cook for my teacher, and I'll drive my teacher, but, you know, I don't want to help some creepy sentient being. You know, well, actually, if we have that view, then we've missed the point of Vajrayana, because in Vajrayana, you're dissolving everything into emptiness and generating everything as the deity in the mandala. So it's not just your teacher that you're seeing as the Buddha, you're trying to see all sentient beings as the Buddha too. So in that kind of context, it makes sense seeing your teacher as the Buddha. What else are you going to do? All these other people around me are Buddhas, but my teacher's a sentient being? You know, that doesn't make any sense. So the whole thing in Vajrayana is that you're trying to constantly do this thing of dissolving things into emptiness and generating them in pure forms, you know, as pure nirmanakayas, as sambhogakayas, dharmakayas. Okay? Yeah? So that makes us feel like the Buddha is more imminent. Okay? Now, you know, when we're trying to see all the people around us as the Buddha, it doesn't mean that from their side they necessarily have become Buddha, and then, you know, we see, you know, John beating up Joe, and we say, well, these two Buddhas are just putting on a play. You know, it's a play of the omniscient mind that John's beating up Joe because this is a pure land and they're both Buddhas and everything's perfect, so I'll just sit here and watch it. No, you know, this whole technique of seeing sentient beings in your environment as a pure land isn't so that you can get into that weird kind of mind state. Yet the whole purpose of that is so that we avoid this critical, judgmental mind that likes to, you know, our picky mind is always complaining about everybody. Yeah? If we see them as a Buddha, then instead of getting angry at them, we're going to think, oh, this is happening because there's something for me to learn in this situation. Maybe what I need to learn is I need to offer some help here because otherwise they're going to kill each other and that's not going to help anybody. Okay? So don't get into this weirded out thing of everything is perfect so anything goes. Yeah? You can, you know, it could very well be that all these people, I mean, we don't know. Joe and John might be Buddhas for all we know. Okay? But the lesson we're supposed to learn from that is not, you know, oh, it's just a play, let them beat each other up. Maybe the lesson is we're supposed to intervene and offer some help. Okay?
I don't like the light
No, when we're saying, I was just using the light beam as an example of illustrating, because you said you didn't understand the difference between seeing your guru as the emanation of the Buddha and seeing them as the Buddha. And the point was, when we see them as an emanation, in our mind, we're creating some space between the Buddha and our teacher. We're still seeing our teacher with a lot of respect, you know, but there's still some space between them and the Buddha. That was the point of the example of a light beam, okay? I'm not saying that your teacher's a light beam and, you know, when you turn off the lights, your teacher's going to disappear and, you know. Don't take the analogy too literally, okay? Yeah.
With the analogy of a mirror being an appropriate one, that the teacher is a reflection, but a reflection is not really necessarily
what that thing is. Huh. It's interesting. Maybe. Yeah, I've never heard that example used in the teachings, but it's quite possible. Yeah, like a reflection of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the whole point, I mean, don't get too hung up in, well, what does it mean? Am I really seeing them as an emanation? You know, the whole point of seeing your teachers this way is so that you listen closely to the teachings. Because the thing is, if we look and we see our teacher, you know, and this applies for any of our teachers, if we say, this person, you know, burp, they fart, they get lost on the highway, you know, they say the wrong things, they write emails and they forget to put the not in, so it has the totally opposite meaning, you know how we do, and they trip, and, you know, they don't explain the teachings clearly, I mean, this person doesn't know anything, you know. Why am I listening to this person teach the Dharma? Because maybe the Dharma they're teaching isn't so pure because they seem a little bit kind of weirded out themselves, you know? I mean, look, they yawn and they fall asleep and, you know. Why should I listen to them teach the Buddha, teach the Dharma? Well, if we have that kind of attitude when we're listening to teachings, not much is going to go in, is it? Because our mind's full of doubt, it's full of skepticism, we're too busy picking faults than we are listening to the meaning of the teaching. So if we have that kind of view, it only harms us. Okay? So the advice about, you know, having a good view of our teacher, it's not because our teachers need respect and honor. Yeah? If a teacher needs respect and honor, they're not a genuine teacher. Okay? It's from our side, we need to have that view of our teachers, you know? And our having that view doesn't benefit the teacher at all because, I mean, we give offerings to the teacher, we create the merit. You know, our merit leads us to enlightenment. The teacher gets a package of incense. What good does that do? Yeah? I mean, and I say this because sometimes, you know, our mind starts thinking, oh, I really hope I can be a Dharma teacher one day because oh, Dharma teachers get treated really well. You know, they pick you up. Like my mother says, oh, do they pick you up at the airport? Do they feed you? Yeah, Mom, they do. Woo, you must be important. Well, you so, you know, we can develop that kind of self-importance ourselves. Oh, you know, they take me at the airport, they feed me, you know, they give me incense, they give me chocolate bars, you know, they say thank you after I teach. I must really be somebody important. Now, let me tell you, it's very easy, you know, when you're a nobody, to start developing an ego over being a Dharma teacher. Yeah, it does you absolutely no benefit, and in fact, it's one of, you know, the ways of, you know, how to get to the hell realm without really trying. Yeah. So the students can give you all sorts of things. They're creating merit to get enlightened, and you're in the process of going to the hell realm because you're taking advantage of them being greedy and attached to offerings and reputation. Okay. So this whole thing of seeing a teacher in a respectful manner does not benefit the teacher. Yeah. It benefits us because it makes us listen closely to the meaning of the teachings and take the teachings seriously and put them into practice. Okay? And if we have that attitude, then our practice is going to take off. Whereas if we're always sitting there and saying, gee, I wish I could be born at the time that, you know, I was really dumb. I should have gotten born at the time of Shakyamuni. I really blew it. You know, well, maybe I should try for Maitreya because they'll teach the real Dharma. But, you know, this person in front of me, I don't know. You know, there's 5 points and they can only remember 4 of them. You know, maybe they even got those 4 wrong. I shouldn't listen to anything. And they're talking about bodhicitta and serving all sentient beings. That is too weird. You know, all sentient beings, I'm supposed to lead that spider to enlightenment. I'm supposed to lead this jerk over here who's taking advantage of me to enlightenment. I mean, this teacher, this bodhicitta stuff is too much. If they're teaching emptiness, they're telling me that what I see doesn't exist. That's dumb, you know. And this one person once said at a Cloud Mountain retreat, you know, he was getting into Buddhism, he said, I began to have some real doubt. You know, there was Paul, Mark, Luke, John. At least those were names I could say. Maybe I should be a Presbyterian again. So we start having those kind of doubts, you know, because the teacher doesn't know what they're talking about. And, you know, maybe I should be a Presbyterian again. Okay. So do you see how this whole value, the attitude, you know, towards our teacher is something, you know, it's not to create an idolization. It's not to create a groupie club. You know, I mean, I really don't like this whole groupie thing that you see sometimes around, you know, in Western Buddhism with all these people kind of parading around their teacher and, you know, doing some big, I mean, it's like with rock stars. And, you know, I mean, I personally find it quite distasteful because, you know, those people one day, you know, their teachers are going to do something they don't like and then their whole faith is going to disappear. Yeah, because they had this groupie mentality that wanted to worship somebody external to them so that they didn't have to take responsibility for changing their own mind. Because if my teacher's a Buddha and he gives me blessed water and a blessing string and a refuge name, I'm closer to enlightenment. If I just hang around this person, they're going to enlighten me because they're the Buddha. So I just have to hang around him some more, and that's all I got to do. But if we have that kind of idea, you know, we're not going to get anywhere on the path because nobody, you know, can do the path for us. We have to practice ourselves. Whereas if we have the proper understanding of what seeing a teacher as the Buddha is, or even we don't want to see our teacher as the Buddha, even just having respect for this person as somebody who knows more than we do on the path, if we have that kind of attitude, then we're going to take the teacher seriously, we're going to use our investigative wisdom, we're going to develop our discriminating wisdom, and we're going to put the teachings into practice, and that's going to take us somewhere on the path. Any other questions? Besides how to spell smelling. Yes.
I have a question about food cessation.
Right.
Now I'm kind of wrong, because I've always thought of this, food cessation just means all that defilement stops. So if that defilement stops, how does that mind go on?
Right. So if the defilement stops, how does the mind go on? Okay, if we have something like ignorance, okay, or anger, and there's different levels of ignorance and different levels of anger, and different levels are removed at path of seeing, different levels are removed at path of meditation, at path of no more learning, okay? These defilements, these are our mental factors, okay? You still have the clear and knowing nature of the mental consciousness. Yeah. When you have, you know, any mental consciousness, you have the primary mind, and then you have different mental factors that accompany it. When we have anger, we have, you know, our primary mental consciousness, and then we have the mental factor of anger and feeling and, you know, all these other, there's five omnipresent mental factors that appear together with that. Okay, that anger contaminates the whole thing. Yeah. Okay? But still, the potential for one moment of clear and knowing giving rise to the next moment of clear and knowing, that exists. So you can remove the part of it that's defiled and just leave that clear and knowing nature. Okay? So that clear and knowing nature is part of the evolutionary Buddha potential, as are all the mental factors like concentration, mindfulness, wisdom, compassion, love, all these mental factors that we have right now that are somewhat polluted, because right now we have them, you know, they arise at the same time as the ignorance arises, okay? But, you know, it's possible for, because they aren't grasping, you know, necessarily grasping at things the same way ignorance is, that those mental factors can be nurtured ad infinitum, and they can continue on to Buddhahood because they rest on the solid foundation of emptiness. That's great, the solid foundation of emptiness. The really emptiness is a very solid foundation, because emptiness is reality. Okay? So, you know, it's possible for the mind and the positive mental factors to continue while the deluded mental factors are stopped, because the deluded mental factors misconceive reality. Okay? So because they misapprehend reality, if we develop wisdom that apprehends reality correctly, then those things get overpowered. And eventually they get chipped away and worn away until they're completely absent. The continuity of mind continues on, going through, you know, the five paths, and especially here, path of seeing, meditation, and path of no more learning. Yeah. Oh, and the true cessation is the absence of whatever defilements have been removed permanently. So true cessation is a negative phenomena.
But it continues.
Yes. But a true cessation isn't impermanent. It's unconditioned. It's a permanent phenomena. Because negative phenomena are, they're an absence.
Yeah.
So an absence doesn't come, or isn't, it isn't produced by a cause. It's just the non-being of that defilement.
Is that why
they're
sometimes called emptiness, like you were saying before?
Yeah, that could be one reason. Right.
Yeah.
But you can also debate that. Okay? So, like a path of seeing, yeah, when you have when you realize emptiness directly for the first time, okay, your mind's in meditative equipoise on emptiness are true paths. Okay? Those true paths, because it's seeing reality directly on path of seeing, they eliminate the acquired afflictions, the acquired disturbing attitudes, so that they don't appear again. So you get that level of true cessation. When you start on the path of meditation, you know, and all the 10 bodhisattva bhumis, which are spread out between path of seeing and path of meditation, then you are eliminating slowly, slowly, slowly more and more defilements as you go up through the bodhisattva bhumis. Okay? So you still have this wisdom realizing emptiness, but because it is becoming more habitual in the mind and making a deeper impression on the mind, this wisdom consciousness, this true path, has the force to eliminate more and more defilements. So those eliminations of those defilements are the new true cessations that come into existence as you progress along the path. Someday maybe we can study Salam. Salam is the path and stages, and it goes into all this in great detail. Okay?
So it's a moment of cessation.
Cessation is the removal, the absence,
so
the exhaustion. It's
a
negative.
Gives rise to another moment removed, which then adds momentum to...
But you see, the true cessation is a permanent phenomena.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So once you got it, you got it.
But it is a phenomenon. It isn't just an absence of...
It isn't an absence. It doesn't mean... is not the... For example, the emptiness of inherent existence does not mean the absence of existent phenomena. It's the absence of inherently existent. Okay?
So... there's mind that's the impermanent phenomena, changing all in my mind. There's true cessation, which is a permanent phenomena. It's kind of a state,
mm-hmm.
sort of accompanies that.
Right, right, right. Yeah, they're existing, you know. The wisdom mind, because when you have, what you have is uninterrupted path and liberated path. We're getting into Salam here, but uninterrupted path, you know, your first moment of direct perception of emptiness and path of seeing, let's say, gives rise to the liberated path, which is the mind that has accompanying with it that true cessation, which is the absence of that particular defilement. Okay?
Yeah. Okay, yes.
Yeah. It's like, you know how we say mind and the emptiness of the mind, they exist simultaneously and together? Well, once you're on the higher stages of the path, the mind and the true cessations exist simultaneously like that. Okay? You don't have to say, gee, I forgot my true cessation. I left it on the path of seeing, and I went, oh, my God, my God. You know? Where's the lost in that? I never had my true cessation back. Okay. Two quick questions, yeah?
So you're saying that, say, a virtuous... thoughts
mm-hmm.
of love contaminated by things.
Uh-huh.
So how can these both be happening at the same time? Are they like
okay.
back and forth?
So how do you have ignorance and love at the same time? Okay. Okay, let's say I am, you know, I'm meditating on love, you know, I'm doing a good job of it, you know, finally sometime, you know, and I have this real feeling of love in my heart for sentient beings, but the way I'm seeing sentient beings, I'm still conceiving them as inherently existent. Okay?
Real virtuous.
It's virtuous, and it's going to lead to enlightenment. But it's contaminated by this grasping. When we've the more and more we realize emptiness, the purer our love becomes. Okay? And that's why, you know, when they talk at the beginning of Bodhicharya, at the beginning of Majjhimika Avatara about the three kinds of compassion, you know, they have the compassion that sees the sentient beings as suffering, the compassion that that sees them as impermanent, and the compassion that sees sentient beings as empty, of inherent existence. You know, and the more we can develop that understanding of emptiness, that's the Nidmet Sewe. Okay, objects lose compassion, that's it. Because the more you perceive, you know, get a sense of that, then the purer your compassion is going to be. Okay? Because, you know, kind of in our ordinary state, we see the sentient beings are inherently existent, my love and compassion are inherently existent, the enlightenment I'm going to attain is inherently existent, I'm inherently existent, you know. So we have all the pieces, but we don't really got it, okay, because we're still seeing everything as inherently existent. So that's why we always try in our dedication to see things as empty. Hmm?
Here's another example of not giving it, or is there an easy way out?
Uh-huh.
How can the impermanent mind have karmic imprints?
How can the impermanent mind have karmic imprints? Because if the mind were permanent, it wouldn't change moment by moment.
But it does change moment by moment.
So it's impermanent.
Karmic imprints will change.
You bet they change moment by moment. Karmic imprints better be impermanent, because if they were permanent, they couldn't bring results. Because anything that's permanent can't bring a result. To be impermanent, which simply means it changes moment by moment, yeah, to bring a result or to exist as a result of a cause means that you change moment by moment.
So even if you do nothing, it still changes moment by moment.
Yep. I mean, that's why I tell people, look at our mind stream. It's changing moment by moment anyway. So we might as well try and make it change in a good way. Right? Yeah? Okay. Now, let's sit quietly for a few minutes.